Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Welcome, everyone. We're delighted to take you through our interim results for the 6 months ending 30th September 2020. I think this presentation, I think many of you have seen this before, so we probably won't cover off our backgrounds and so on to the same extent as we have done in the past. I'm Neil Gandy. I'm co-founder and CEO, as you know, alongside Ollie Rigby. Many of you already know our board members, so Mark, Isabel and Chris have been with us since the very beginning. And we recently were joined on the board by Rachel Neiman. I think the reason for that is because today, as you see, 70% of our revenue on a stat basis is from public sector in the UK. We felt that we needed somebody on the board who understood digital and public sector in the UK. And Rachel was a leading voice in the establishment of GDS, working with Frances Maud. She was the first chief digital officer at the UK Department of Health and has gone on to lead a number of other organisations in UK technology, public sector since then. So she adds a great voice and experience to our board, and we're delighted to welcome her. Moving on, let me rattle through, I guess, initially just the results and so on, before handing over to Ollie, who will take you through the numbers in substantially more detail. So for those who don't know us, we're a digital transformation consultancy. Our unit of measure is a day rate, or the unit that we sell is a day rate. We're not a product company. We don't claim to be a product company. We work predominantly in digital transformation in the UK public sector. As I said, 70% of last half revenue was in the public sector. We work in central government, local government, health, housing, higher education, not-for-profit and the commercial sectors. Around about half of our people are technologists, deep technology experts, but alongside that, strategy and design, and that's really important. When I come and talk about our full service value proposition, I think that's what really sets us apart from others in the space. We operate, as I say, in government digital transformation, which is a huge and growing market worth £20 billion in the UK by 2025 alone, plus, of course, the commercial bit. But just if we focus on that, then that's a massive market that we're operating within. Competitive landscape. Let's start with it. So in trying to place our organization in the grid, we came up with two axes. So the vertical is digital native. So what do we mean by that? Well, specifically, if you look at technology, you look at software, you look at how software was generated in the past versus how software is created today. Today, it takes 20 or 30 people probably to create the most amazing of products, the most amazing software. And the reason for that is because of agile methodology, because of hyperscale cloud, because of code repositories like GitHub. The reality is, in the past, is the same job would have taken hundreds of people many years. And the challenge I think that most of our older competitors, the monoliths that we call them, face is that, today we can deliver world-class, at-scale products for public sector and other sectors for literally a fraction of the cost that it takes some of those other organizations who are trying desperately hard to keep their hundreds of thousands of people busy. And that represents, we think, that represents an existential threat to the very large organizations. If they were truly honest with themselves, we believe that they would probably shrink by 90% and just leave the core of the very best people that were there. But clearly, they're not going to go and do that on a voluntary basis. So we're in this game of presenting ourselves as the modern alternative, the full service model alternative. And that takes us to the horizontal axis, which is full service. There are many pure technology consultancies out there. One of the challenges they have is they typically only get involved in an engagement once the thing has been specced. And more often than not, once the business case is signed off or once it's gone through a discovery phase, the next phases are the vendors for the next phases are largely locked in. That's how the very big organizations do it. They get in right at the very beginning, they create the business case. Of course, they shape it in such a way that it kind of ends up being given to them for the broader rollout. And again, I'll explain that later on. We have created an end-to-end value proposition whereby we also are capable of creating the business cases, doing everything from treasury green book right the way through to running live services. Now, there are many, many digital native organizations that are niche and small. The challenge they face is that they're never going to be given the larger engagements that are out there. We believe today that we are the only full-service, digital native, modern services company out there pitching into government. And I think that's a really exciting future for us. So quick rattle through the top line numbers, and Ollie will go through this in much more detail shortly. So we're delighted with revenue at 21.2 million, up 58% on a stat basis, but actually up 18% on an organic like-for-like basis. EBITDA, 2.9, up 142%, and again, 37% on a like-for-like basis. So great growth on both of those key numbers. Cash up 5.9. Now, bear in mind that we've used 3.1 for acquisition. So to find ourselves with cash in that position is fantastic. This is a great cash generative business. Cash conversion ratio 102% in the first half. Sales backlog at 17.5 million. As we came into this second half, 17.5 million of revenue for the half was already booked. Clearly, if you take 21.2, add it to 17.5, you get to 38.7. I think Dowgate had 42.5 million for us for the full year. I believe that's been upgraded this morning to 44.5 million. And you know, historically, this business has always been second half weighted. Last year, it was 45% first half, 55% second half. We feel we're in good shape, even for the upgraded number as well. But the way you measure this business, I mean, people talk about dilution and acquisitions, and it's all correct. But the real way that you measure this business is by looking at adjusted diluted earnings per share. If you want to pick in a number and measure us in the future, then I think this is the number that you measure us on, because every acquisition we do is accretive and adds to our EPS number. So 6 months to September 2020, our EPS of 2.6 pence, up 100% on the EPS from a year earlier. And Ollie will come and explain later on some of the dynamics that drive that EPS, which is the real sense of health of the business. So look, we've had a fantastic first half. Really delighted to share this with you. Ollie's going to take you through the numbers in more detail now, and then I'll come back and talk about the sort of growth strategy for the future.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us today. Delighted to share with you the numbers in a bit more detail. Revenue significantly up on prior year, up by 58%. Obviously, we've made some acquisitions that bolster that number. On a like-for-like basis, last year's number would have been £17.7 million, so still growth of 18%. And so 21.2, also against the full year last year of 31.5, really showing the growth as we go forward the remainder of the year. EBITDA, this is the first time we've reported EBITDA on a post-IFRS 16 basis. IFRS 16 impacts the way that leases are treated, and it effectively moves part of the cost of the lease to below EBITDA. This is the statute where we have to report it. And so for consistency, rather produce two different numbers, we've decided to report on it going forward. If you wanted to compare this against the pre-IFRS 16 number, there's about a £300,000 difference this year. So a pre-IFRS 16 number would have been 2.6, post-IFRS 16 is 2.9. But significant growth on prior year, up 142%, improvement in margin, and I'll talk about that in a few slides time. But also on a like-for-like basis, yeah, we were at 2.1 million EBITDA last year on a like-for-like basis. And again, so that's an organic like-for-like growth of 37%, which we're really pleased with. This next slide gives you a little bit of a breakdown of where that £21.2 million worth of revenue comes from in the half. So 90% of that revenue came from either recurring or repeat customers, so customers we've built in prior periods. Again, I think that shows the visibility of our backlog at the end of a prior period and the contracted business that we had and the backlog we had in place at that time. We've won circa £25 million worth of new contracts, or we signed circa £25 million worth of new contracts in the first half of this year. And so I expect to see some of that being delivered in the second half of the year, and therefore the split between recurring, repeat and new will shift slightly, and we'll see more new come into play as we look at the full year going forward. A couple of sort of highlights here for the year. Neil's already touched on EPS and cover that again in a few slides time. We're pleased to report our first dividend So an interim dividend of 0.2p per share, which will be payable in January. We obviously finished the period strongly with 17.5 million of backlog, as Neil's already talked to, and strong cash position again, as we talked to. In the period, we increased our borrowing facilities with HSBC to £7 million, up from £5 million. And so net debt at the end of the period finished at £1.1 million. Just to pick up a couple of more statistics around in the middle line there, looking at adjusted EBITDA margin, significant increase from 8.6 to 13.6. In our full RNS, we talked a little bit about the impact of COVID on margins. We put an estimate that there was about a £250,000 impact improvement on EBITDA as a result of COVID, mainly as a result of reduced spending on entertaining, travel, and some rent savings. We also probably benefited from some COVID-related projects, but I think that was probably offset in equal measure by some projects that we saw delayed or postponed as a result of COVID. So if you were to take that £250,000 off EBITDA, then that would bring the margin down to 12.5%, still a significant increase year on year. One of the reasons for all that is that our central cost base remains largely flat. So we built a central cost base. You know, if you've been on this before, you'll have heard me talk about this before. We built a central team to scale this business and to deliver on the commercial vision we have to reach 100 million. Of revenue by 2023, run rate by 2023. And that central cost base has been built to deliver that and will largely remain unchanged as we scale. So you can see that central cost base as a percentage of revenue drop significantly between this year and last year, down to 7.1% in the prior year. A couple of other numbers here. We've talked about public services revenue, so about 70% in public services, which means about 30% is in private sector. Pleased that the private sector business also grew at about 15% on a like-for-like basis. Collaborative revenue was 10.2 million, 48% of total revenue. That compares against 28% of total revenue in the prior period. Again, just showing the maturity of the group coming together and our brand strategy around bringing companies under specific go-to-market brands. Top 10 customers was 34%, down from 42% a year ago. And repeat customers, we're seeing continued repeat customers, which shows that sort of the life cycle of digital transformation and the relationships that you build and the critical nature of our relationships with our customers continues. This is the sort of more detailed P&L, which I'll run through. So we've got H1 in the first column, H1 2020 in the second column, and the full year in the third column, and then a like-for-like number in the column across from that. I think we've already talked about sort of high-level numbers. What I will focus on is the kind of loss after tax, or the bottom number here. And there's a number of adjusting items that take us down into a loss for the year that we believe don't represent the underlying performance of the business. So just to flick onto the next slide, that will talk about this. So here we have the loss profit before tax number on the prior slide. Now that is after a £2.5 million charge in relation to a loss on movement in fair value consideration. So what this is that at the point we make acquisitions, we make a best estimate of the value of any deferred consideration that might be paid out. And where companies overperform, that results in a change in the accounting estimate, effectively, or realization of that estimate. And if they overperform, that results in a charge in the P&L. So this charge here effectively relates to overperformance and is a non-cash item. Equally, amortization is just the amortization of those acquisitions, and again is a non-cash item. The costs due to acquisitions and restructuring relate to the acquisitions we made for Arthurly and Different in the period, and again a non-recurring. And then there's a share-based payment charge, which again is a non-cash item. Impacting for tax, that takes you down to an adjusted profit before tax number of about 2.1 million. And as I said, management, that's a much better a view of the underlying health and success of the period. If we then move on to look at earnings per share, the way that we calculate earnings per share is to take the weighted average basic shares in issue during the period. So that's the 56.9 million at the top of this slide here. Then we take a very prudent view of further dilution. So we look at the consideration that is due and payable, and we estimate that on a maximum dilution basis. So assuming maximum dilution, that would result in another 18.7 million shares being issued. based on the current share price at about £1.75, that reduces to 8.5 million shares to be issued. So it's a significant impact or reduction in the dilution impact of those acquisition shares, which would also have a knock-on impact on EPS and would push that from 2.6p up to 2.9p. This slide covers our pro forma results. So these numbers are reflective of if all of the businesses we've acquired or we own at the end of the period had been owned for the whole of the half and had been owned for the whole of the prior year half as well. Again, you can see very strong performance in terms of revenue and EBITDA growth. Moving on to cash flow. So again, this shows why adjusted profit and adjusted operating profit is a much better view of the underlying performance of the group, translates much better into cash and the cash statistics here. So cash generated from operating activities post-tax at 3.1 million. Now, we benefited in the half from some delayed payments on VAT, PAYE and NI as a result of some of the government holidays. That all of that has been repaid post-period end. But that took cash to about, it would have been 2.2 million of cash generated from operations, and hence the 102% sort of cash conversion ratio that we talked about earlier in the presentation. Cash used in the net investing activities. So we paid out £3.5 million broadly. That was made up of 3.9 million in cash outflow for acquisitions. And we acquired cash of about 0.8. And then some other payments to deferred consideration that had related to previous deals. We had one deal, which was the FutureGov deal, where we had a very small element of cash consideration as part of the deferred element, and that's been satisfied now. There are no other deferred payments to be made in cash. Cash generated from finance activities covers the £2 million of additional loan that we took out with HSBC, offset by lease and interest payments to bring that down to £1.5 million. We finished the period, as Neil talked about, and we talked about £5.9 million of cash and net debt position of about £1.1 million. In terms of balance sheet, there's a couple of things I'll pull out here, but very quickly. The first thing is to say that the contingent consideration in here as a liability is non-cash, as we've talked about. So, you know, we'll be satisfied through the issue of shares. And we've already talked about the likely impact of that. And then from a current ratio perspective, we remove that from that statistic, as well as the deferred tax piece. And that gives us a current ratio of 1.7. So it shows the balance sheet in a very healthy position at the end of the period. And that's it from me in terms of numbers. Over to you now.
Thank you very much. Let me take you through, I guess, our growth strategy moving forward. I talked about the market that we're in. It's a huge and growing market. And every survey, every study that you look at always says the same thing, effectively, which is, particularly the post-COVID world, it is accelerating the trend in digital transformation. The survey that we've used here for the bar chart is a Harvey Nash KPMG CIO survey done a couple of months ago. I think it was August or something like that, which is, you know, a key question in light of your new reality, the reality that we face today. What are your most important technology investments? And you see we put a red box around the areas that we play in. So we play in five of the top six key areas of investment. So not only are we in a growth market of digital transformation in public sector, but of that growth market, we're at the top end of where people are putting their money. And we have world-class value propositions in each of those five areas. You know, a recent survey by Dodds, I think it carried out over the course of the summer that I've just been reading, talks about operational efficiency and simplification as a key driver. And really, if you look at the work that we do, it drives those operational efficiencies and simplification. We look at some of the, particularly in live services, some of the costs incurred by government today are just insane, I have to say. And, you know, we know that we can make a profound difference to some of those run costs, as well as some of those build costs that government has historically been paying. You know, we look at just in local governments, some £300 million worth of contract are expiring in the next year. And I talked about this, the public, the IO information around digital transformation in the UK public sector being £20 billion by 2025. So we are in a huge growth market and a huge growth opportunity. And I think our opportunity really is to take on some of those larger players. They've had it to themselves. They're in our minds, they're grossly inefficient. They do not represent great value for taxpayers. They do not turn out great outcomes for citizens. And our opportunity is to really do that. But moving on to the next slide, the only way we can do that is if we could truly deliver an end-to-end value proposition. And when we say end-to-end in government digital, we mean everything from business case creation at the very formal end, that's the Treasury Green Book. Take Somerset Council as an example of writing a full Treasury Green Book business case for bringing together smaller local authorities to create Somerset County Council, right the way through to running live services. And the reason it's important to do the business case work is because quite often in the business case work, that's where you're shaping future engagements, is where you're shaping technology programs. And if you can be there at the beginning of shaping some of those technology programs, then we put ourselves in prime position to start to win the discovery phase through to the alpha phase, through to beta, and increasingly, and a big growth area for us is moving into running live services. Running live services is where multi-year recurring revenue opportunities in public sector truly exists. Now, we believe, we've yet to be corrected on this, but we believe that we are the only digital native, modern, full service digital transformation consultancy in the UK that can offer this full range of services, end-to-end range of services. And as a consequence of that, we truly believe we've only just got into our stride. You know, from here, we have the opportunity to really start to go at some of those legacy organizations, some of those monolithic organizations that in our minds represent really bad value for taxpayers. And, you know, as we go into a world where in this year, I think the government is providing COVID support to the tune of £280 billion. Next year, already forecast to be providing COVID support to the tune of £55 billion. In our minds, what that means is the spotlight will shine brightly on cost, particularly wasteful costs that go on today, or costs that could be trimmed quite dramatically that are going on today. So we think, again, this pandemic for us has been a market opportunity. Obviously, terrible situation for many, many people, and my own family included. But certainly from a business perspective, a huge opportunity to drive a change through the way that technology is procured and delivered inside the public sector. So we're really super happy that we are now this full service organization. You know, how do we drive our growth? Three strong pillars of growth. Firstly, organic. Now, you know, if we're an end-to-end value proposition, it makes no sense for us to have these 11, 12, 13, 15 brands or whatever it is over time. You know, the customer is a really simple value proposition. We are the modern alternative. And we do that today in two brands, and I'm about to talk about a third. But today our two brands, and we focus on the economic buyer. So FutureGov, very much focused on the CEO, COO of organizations, speaking about digital transformation in the language of the CEO, COO. Foundry 4, talking about digital transformation in the language of the chief information officer, the chief technology officer. Obviously, there's in that Venn diagram, the crossover is the chief digital officer in the middle. But there is a third opportunity as well, which is about head of digital, which is a much more commercial role in the commercial sector. In e-commerce, for example, that's cost of customer acquisition, that's customer lifetime value. In not-for-profits, that's engaging donors, attracting donors, the donation pipeline. So that those will be our three brands. So the two are live already, and we're integrating our companies into those two, and you'll see us introduce a third. Now, at that point, we don't mind which front door you come in. You know, if you're a CEO looking at digital transformation, come into the FutureGov front door. We will be able to sell you the entire value proposition of the group, but in your in the language that you feel comfortable with. Same with the CTO, CIO, and same with head of digital. But internally, our goal is to meet in the middle. So if you take Land Registry as an example of this, of where this consolidation of brands means that we can go out and win bigger deals and show the customer that we're an integrated operation. This Land Registry is a great deal. 3.2 million won by FutureGov. Looking at it from a service design perspective, 1.6 million won by Foundry 4. Looking at it from a technical product management perspective with a view towards, and they selected us because they knew we were, that both brands were part of the same group, and figured that we would help them knit those two pieces together. So, you know, £5.8 million contract there. But other contracts as a result, I think, of bringing our brands together, demonstrating scale, Planning Inspectorate won in post-period, £4 million contract. Bloomberg Philanthropies, we announced that much earlier in the year, a £4 million contract. But News International, News UK, more than £2 million. Welsh Government, more than £1 million. So, you know, we're seeing this play out and drive the organic growth. And we're focused very much on winning those bigger opportunities. If you go back to the collective multi-decade history of all of our companies, in that history, the companies had only won collectively two £4 million deals. Today, Q1, we did a £4 million deal. Q2, we did a £4 million deal. Q3, we won a £4 million deal, and we hope in Q4 we'll follow through with that as well. So those bigger deals are certainly coming through, driving that organic growth. On the acquisition front, we continue to make earnings enhancing. Every acquisition we ever make will drive that EPS positively. So from a, you know, people talk about dilution and so on, as Ollie explained, you know, the dilution has a smaller and smaller impact. And also you've seen us make a change in the way that we acquire companies recently. You've seen us use much more cash and fewer shares, again, driving that EPS number. The key measure of ours is that adjusted, fully diluted EPS number, as I said at the beginning. So two acquisitions in the period, different, very much put us in the healthcare sector. So now 16% of pro forma group pro forma revenues now come from healthcare. You know, healthcare, NHS is one of those seemingly impenetrable things to get into. But once you're in them and know your way around, then it's a huge opportunity. And we see our, you know, we see our pipeline in healthcare growing quite dramatically. Small acquisition, Arthurly, added a deep layer of technology skills around Microsoft Azure, but also other cloud platforms. And actually, Arthurly introduced a new term to us, which was a polyglot engineer. So a software engineer, an architect that understands equally well Azure as AWS, as Google Cloud Platform, and is able to present to the client the optimized solution for running costs based upon how those different platforms work. Again, I think that puts us in a phenomenal position moving forward to run live services for public sector. And the other thing that Arthurly does is gives us a toehold in the utility sector, which is a huge, we think, is a new growth market for us. And I guess expect to see some more from that from us in the future. You know, last year we invested quite a bit in intelligent automation and conversational AI as growth areas for the future. We're really pleased to say that, you know, that has paid off in droves, 288% revenue growth, albeit off small numbers last year, but 288% revenue growth in that area. Clients today, Home Office, Irish Government, Kettering General Hospital, NHS Trust, and Avaya, the global contact center company, and many, many more. So, you know, that is really on growing at a huge trajectory for us right now. So really excited. So, yeah, these are the ways in which we are planning to grow. It's how we've been growing and how we continue to plan growing for the future towards hitting that, as you all know by now, March 23, 100 million run rate revenue, 12 to 14 million EBITDA. And we're in great shape to be hitting those numbers. I'm very, very confident of hitting that goal, as I say, by March of 23. I guess to wrap up, quickly, it's been a phenomenal period. I've got to say that I would like to thank our staff. You know, they went into lockdown beginning of March, often faced difficult home circumstances, trying to teach children or dealing with loneliness or living in, you know, shared accommodation that's less than ideal from a working perspective, and yet somehow have smashed utilization, have won record levels of new business, you know, and continue to deliver high quality work for clients despite these circumstances. I pay tribute to them. I think they've done an amazing job. We've delivered strong revenue and EBITDA performance because of them, and because of their energy and commitment. You know, we've made great progress against our growth strategy. We said 10 to 15% organic growth in that plan to 100 billion. We've declared our first dividend, a milestone. we've always said from IPO that we want to be, you know, profitable, cash generative, dividend paying stock, and we've got there, so we're really happy with that. And in terms of outlook, massive market, but it's not just a massive market, it's a shift in the market away from, you know, we will take market share from the Capgeminis, the Accentures, and so on, because we just don't believe that they're fit for purpose in many areas across the public sector and actually other sectors as well. We will continue to focus on ever improving margins. You know, we make no apology for the fact that we are a consultancy. We sell a day rate, and as a consequence of that, we ensure that we've got great cash conversion. There's no, you know, massive spend in R&D or other capital expenses that kind of eat into cash. I think we have reached that critical mass. So that end-to-end value proposition, that's pretty much the first time, you know, having acquired Amio in March, integrated them into FutureGov in the last couple of months, in the last 6 weeks or so. It's pretty much the first time we've been able to put that slide together and give that slide to our teams and say, this is the group, right? This is the group that you work within. Go out and pitch that to our new and existing customers. And we continue to target those earnings enhancing acquisitions. I mean, we, you know, we've long said that we're a purposeful company. We are here to deliver not just the growth and the profits and the cash. We're also here to make a big difference in society. You cut the 400 people through the middle, there is a deep desire to improve society. And that sort of drives the kind of projects that we end up delivering. Now, what that also does, though, is it attracts a certain type of acquisition towards us. We are never the top payers for acquisitions. You know, we say to people in M&A conversations, look, you can go and sell for more to others. You know, if you want the maximum cash and go sit on the beach, then probably go and talk to somebody else because you're not going to get it here. What we're here to do is to help founders of businesses really fulfill on their destiny of improving public services. An example would be Rach Murphy from different company that we acquired, as you know, in September. Rach was formerly a CIO, in the NHS, Chief Information Officer in the NHS. She then went and set up the consultancy part of Different, grew that to £6 million revenue. But she did it because she wanted to create the kind of company that would benefit the NHS. And clearly she had a great impact and created a phenomenal £6 million company. But today she runs health across a £50 million run rate company. If you take Ollie's pro forma slide, a £50 million run rate company. And you know, the ability to therefore drive greater impact has grown dramatically. And all of the M&A conversations, we began at an origination process again in the summer, early summer. We've had many tens of conversations through that. And the companies that are still in the pipeline are people that are also committed to changing public services. And you end up in this virtuous circle where, you know, we keep delivering on great work and change public services for the better. We attract companies towards us that are less motivated by the absolutes of cash that they can possibly get, but actually as much motivated by creating a great home for their employees and also creating this a platform for them to really deliver even more change, a positive change in the public sector. And this thing just grows and grows and grows as a consequence of that. So we're really delighted with the results and very happy to take any questions.
Blaine Tatum asks, hi both. Looking at slide 7, who do you come up against most often in bidding situations? And please could you give us some colour on competitive pressures for public sector contracts?
Blaine, that's a really difficult question to answer because it depends on a bid by bid and also sort of subsector by subsector. So local government will be, you know, sometimes the North Gates of the world. And capitas and so on and so forth. In central, it'll be a different group. And sometimes, you know, you get this, if you take a G-Cloud opportunity, often, you know, 20 or 30 companies will have done the initial submission. We're a bit cleverer than that. We have this Slack channel where our group is now pretty connected. And so there's an, I've just seen one just now, there's an opportunity for a department. It looks like a good opportunity for us, but before we even bid it, we're going to do some digging around and figure out if it's a shoe-in for somebody else or if it's it really is a genuine opportunity to win. And I guess the reason that's important is because you have to be very careful with your bid resources as to where you place them. You know, one of my first boss a long time ago once said, you know, taught me something which I've kept with for the whole of my working life, which is never work on a deal you can't win. And I think we take that to heart through the organization. So we work to ensure that despite the fact that there might seemingly be lots of bidders, we try and make sure we direct our efforts to ones that we can genuinely get at least shortlist of. Sometimes we take a department where, you know, we're not in yet, and we know that it's going to take three or four bids for us to get our name around the organization, sufficiently around the organization for us to then go on and win it. And so sometimes we take that approach, but it's a very deliberate approach if we do. So not answering your question directly around who do we see. It sort of depends whether it's a framework bid or if it's a direct award, whether it's a central versus local or healthcare. It sort of varies. I think there is some pricing pressure because some organizations have been struggling a bit, and they're trying to drive trying to win at all costs. I think that's a red herring for us generally, because the real opportunity is to go and win against the big four. I can't name the example at the moment. We'll do in January, I think. There's an example was a project that we delivered as a group for £5.5 million. And yet one of the big organizations delivered a very similar project for another part of government for £495 million. I mean, you know, there's pricing pressure. We can hit our gross margin targets comfortably and still deliver a like for like project for a 90th of the price. That's the opportunity we're really talking about here. It's about us educating government that the old way really isn't fit for purpose. And you know, the new way is a profound change and a real opportunity. And particularly when we're carrying phenomenal amounts of debt as a country, then these are the approaches that really have to be looked at.
Thank you. And a follow-on from Nigel Seddon, who asks, can you disclose broadly what your bid win rate is? Is it getting better?
So again, I talked to we tend to try and bid for stuff that we believe we can win, or there's a reason for bidding it, knowing that we probably won't initially. I don't have the stats across the board, but we will probably work. I'm guessing that we probably work in a kind of about a third. Somewhere between a quarter and a third of what we bid is what we typically win. We aim to shortlist almost everything, on everything.
And Nigel Seddon has another question. If you win a significant piece of work from the competition, would you do a 2P transfer in of staff from that competitor? And if not, how would you resource?
We don't do those kind of deals. We're not after those kind of 2P. We don't outsource. We work with, not for, and that's a profoundly different approach. We're happy to upskill, work alongside and upskill client teams. Again, profoundly different approach to the black box type of approach of the monoliths. Government is looking to upskill their digital capability. They want to work with partners who can help them upskill their digital capability. They're looking for partners who can integrate their people into their teams, not on an employment basis, but on a team and delivery basis, and that's, we're very comfortable working in that way. So no, we don't do 2Ps. How do we staff? Well, we staff by both growing our full time headcount as we grow, and our and we have a contractor base as well. We grew 57 people something like 17-18% growth in headcount during the course of the first half, despite lockdown, despite all the rest of it. And that's a net 57 new hires over that period. So we would continue growing that way. We obviously have the Bulgarian engine room, what we call our engine room, which is our business based in Sofia in Bulgaria, really proven to have worked across the group with our intelligent automation business. All of their developers as they grow are based out of Sofia. And with their sort of client-facing type people based out of the UK. And now beginning to extend that into other parts of the group as well.
Great. And that's the end of questions. Do you have any closing remarks, Neil?
No, just to reiterate, really, our thanks to our employees. I mentioned it earlier, and I think I want to mention it again if I can. They truly remarkable job. You know, I recall coming into this period, sitting in February, remember thinking this is going to be a big threat. This is a problem. And the unpredictability of that time, if you all recall, I guess, you know, we sat and laid out a set of values that we thought would guide our decision making through a period of great uncertainty. We said that we would try and hold on to our people at almost at all costs. We wouldn't take, as a set of them laid out in the RNS, but we wouldn't take any long-term government support. We wanted the commercial freedom. We wanted to leave the sort of government resources for others that needed it more than we did. We said that we wouldn't make any temporarily sort of any roles that were temporarily underutilized. We wouldn't make redundant. In fact, we said we'd pay them full and we'd get those people to, if they wanted to, obviously, but we'd get those people to volunteer in their communities. And I think those values have stood us in good stead. It's those values that saw us through this incredibly difficult period for many people. And so, again, I'd like to close by thanking our staff.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.